Blog Talk Radio.
This is Shared Sacrifice. We're actually Deflection 2016 right now, of course, sponsored by Shared Sacrifice. I am Gary Barkley. I have Matt Stannard on with me tonight. I hope the music is not over my voice. I'm trying to, that they've changed the way the studio kind of works, and so it's kind of hard to control the sound of the background music. So I'll go ahead and turn that off.
I can hear you.
Well, go ahead. Today is Thursday, September 8th, 2016. Deflection 2016, sponsored by Shared Sacrifice Media. I am Gary Barkley again. Matt Stannard is on the line with me, as you heard his voice there. We are going to be doing this show as a special kind of a feature of Shared Sacrifice through every Thursday between now and the election. I do want to point out that two Thursdays from now, the 22nd, I doubt that we'll have an episode because there's an event going on in our lives, and so we won't be doing the show. But of course, our audience is always important to us. But we want to let you know in advance that we won't be doing it next or 2 Thursdays from now.
Two weeks.
Not next weekend. Yeah. Next week will be the.
We'll 15th. Be around next weekend. Yeah,
it will be the 22nd would be that, and then we'll go on through the election. The election being, of course, on a Tuesday, the 8th. We haven't yet discussed whether or not we'll have one on the 10th after the election. Of course, we'll be picking. I mean, I'm sure we'll be picking through the smoldering rubble of a Trump victory, let's really hope not. I know. It'd just be horrible. I mean, after the fiasco last night, I loved the way that Twitter went ahead and started trending, lowering the bar, because that's exactly what happened. It's funny that Donald Trump comes on there, a person who has no military experience, and basically says, I'll fire all the general staff. I'll just fire him, because firing people is what he does. He has no conception of what it actually takes to not only run a military but what it takes to run a business. I mean, keep in mind Forbes did an analysis and said that if he had just taken what his dad gave him and just maintained it without playing all these other stupid games, he'd have more money than he has now. He's lost more money than he would have had just maintaining the properties his dad left him. The guy's an incompetent. He's a boob. He should not be president. Cannot be president. And if he becomes president, I'm a person, I know I'm a war vet and all that. I don't own a gun. If he becomes president, that's my first purchase.
Wow. not a bottle of scotch?
No. I'm pretty much already stocked up on that. I'll have a few cigars, but I'll pass the background check. my first purchase, Donald Trump is elected president, I buy a gun because I know that the Trump red shirts are going to be coming. Because, it's going to be liberals. If you're not sufficiently loyal to Donald Trump, they're coming for you.
Well, here's the thing, actually, and I was just thinking about this yesterday. That's going to happen whether Trump wins or loses.
I thought about that, too.
I don't see the math for a Trump victory. I just don't see the math. I've been saying that all along. I continue to say that. I don't care what these sort of meaningless national polls will come out and say.
Agreed.
I mean, because there was this brief NBC or CNN or one of these outfits last week. Came out and said, well, Trump actually has a 2-point lead. That same poll corrected itself the next day and said, no, actually there isn't a 2-point lead. But if you go by any measure of doing the math and doing the speculative math based on even the most generous interpretations, I don't think it's going to happen. But anything's possible. We know that from the results of many elections, like the 2000 election. And in fact, one of the things that I've been doing, this would be a nice little lighthearted introduction on my part is I've been reading about strange presidential elections in the past, and there's been quite a few of them, and I'm going to quickly share this, and then we can talk about some contemporary headlines, because I know that you've got some things that that came across your pages today, Gary. But so in 1876, there was a strange election with a strange tiebreaker. So this was Rutherford B. Hayes, his election as president, and this is according to CNN Politics, a story from October of last year, because they started a bunch of news or outlets have said, if you think this election's weird, here's some elections from the past that were also weird. And so in 1876, Rutherford B. Hayes' election as president also marked the end of Reconstruction in the South, the article says. Democrat Samuel Tilden had beaten Republican Rutherford Hayes, snared a quarter million more ballots in the popular vote, had 19 more votes in the Electoral College. The problem was that Tilden, the Democrat, was one Electoral College vote away from a majority of 185 votes, and four states comprising a total of 20 votes, and those states were Florida, Louisiana, South Carolina, and Oregon, were disputing the results. In the southern states, each party was accusing the other of fraud. With no precedent to lean on, the two parties agreed to establish a 15-member commission made up of seven Republicans, seven Democrats, and an independent. The independent was Supreme Court Justice David Davis, however, and he was unexpectedly selected by the Illinois legislature to serve in the U.S. Senate. He was replaced by Justice Joseph Bradley, a diehard Republican who would cast every vote for Hayes, providing him the 20 votes he needed for the majority. Democrats initially threatened to block the decision, but in a backroom deal, they agreed to drop their opposition if Hayes, among other provisions, removed federal troops that had been in the South under Reconstruction. So Hayes was sworn in without having won the popular vote or the Electoral College on March 5th, 1877, and within weeks he removed federal troops from the South. Reconstruction formally came to an end, halting the progress African Americans had made, and it would be decades, of course, as you know, Gary, before civil rights would see serious discussion again in Congress. And so if you think that things are crazy now, it has ever been thus, as they say.
Well, you know, I had no idea. That is absolutely fascinating. I'm flabbergasted. I love that kind of historical context. But, you know, I think that and that kind of goes back to it's almost not nearly. I mean, what you've just described is mind blowing. It's almost like what happened in 2000 with Bush v. Gore. Where, you know, Gore, of course, being the statesman, said, you know what, he won the Electoral College because, of course, the Supreme Court, they should not have stepped in. It was a state issue, and the state
Supreme
Court was prepared to let it go on, and the state Supreme Court was prepared to go on. But, of course, Gore would have won, and he would have taken it.
Yeah. One of the many reasons why I don't buy the whole Nader cost Gore the election myth. Happened was Gore was going to win the election in the Supreme Court. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I think the strongest case you could make against Gore on that. And because I've never believed for a second that anyone but the candidates themselves win or lose campaigns. Nader lost the campaign himself. He didn't win it for George Bush. He lost it himself. He was running for president. Actually, that's not true. And I'm going to say this because you and I were putting this show kind of together in 2008. When Nader was running for president, and we couldn't get his campaign manager was asleep literally four times that I called.
Yeah,
I called
yeah.
him.
Well,
and
this,
woke
I mean,
him
that
off.
Was and yeah, and that was times. Nader. That was the post Green Nader. Of course, Nader was never a member of the Green Party, but he ran as an independent the last couple of times because in 2004, my good friend David Cobb was the Green nominee. And then, of course, in 2008, the Green Party nominee was Cynthia McKinney, who we interviewed on the show.
We interviewed, yes.
But But yeah. Nader continued to run as an independent, and was just, became less and less effective, I think, as that kind of maverick voice.
But I think the
interesting thing about this bizarre 1876 election is, you know, some people have said, well, you know, what would happen? And of course, for many people, Gary Johnson was figuring into this scenario, but unfortunately,
not anymore, though.
Not anymore,
not last night.
Because he doesn't read the newspapers. But the speculation that I had heard is, you know, what would happen if nobody wins a majority of the electorate? Obviously, that's the, you know, that's sort
of the House of Representatives,
you know,
and the Republicans give it to Donald.
Yeah, if no one gets to 270, then it would go to the House of Representatives, and presumably they would pick the Republican. But I mean, I don't know if that's a given, and so interesting to read about some of these crazy tiebreakers and other situations we've had.
Well, you know, that is a very interesting point, because I do think that when it comes down to it, there are – I mean, yes, you have the radical right wing. You have the Tea Partiers still, those last dead enders, I'm sure that the former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld would say, the dead enders in the Tea Party in the House would definitely want to go and give it to Trump. But I really think at the end of the day – given that even if Trump becomes president in such a scenario, that those voters, those Republicans that would vote to give Trump the presidency would face the voters in 2 years. There is no mechanism in the U.S. for Donald Trump to say, hey, we're not going to have elections this year because, well, I'm president and I don't want them. That's exactly what Hitler did after he became president. There's not going to be any more elections. Or after he became chancellor, there's not going to be any more elections. There's simply no, there's simply no mechanism, and there's no way the American people would accept that. And there, you really would see violent revolution in that case, because there wouldn't really be a revolution, because it would be the government that has actually caused the revolution. You know, they've usurped the authority of the people, because that's what the Constitution does, right? The Constitution defines the authority of the people to regulate the government, and through elections. At least, at the very least, and if Donald Trump became president through the House, those people think, oh, you know what, we're going to have to face the voters in 2 years. You know, the damage that guy can do in the first 30 days is going to be enough for people that in states that allow it to recall their congressman, and there will be enough recalls to impeach him. So, I mean, there's a lot of mechanisms. It's going to be – you know, I actually found myself today thinking, you know, I don't want him to become president. I do not want him to become president. But I'm just out of intellectual curiosity, let's see how bad can get. Because that's
– you know, you're not the only one. And I mean, obviously, I wouldn't wish that on people. Distinction I always make, and I'm not, you know, pretending that this is a perfect distinction, but the distinction I always make is, you know, to me, and as you know, I'm deeply dissatisfied with the major party, both major parties in the United States, and
absolutely,
you know, what I feel is that, you know, one of those parties represents the sort of controlled violence, institutional violence of neoliberalism, and Trump's candidacy, you know, for the Republicans, represents the sort of uncontrolled violence and brutality of, you know, what I call incipient fascism. Which is better? I mean, you know, it's some of it is that, you know, sort of the devil you know versus the devil you don't. I am not, and nor have I ever said that the two candidates are the same or that the two parties are the same. I just feel like they serve different functions in what is fundamentally an unstable and unjust order. So what do you do? Well, you turn to the third parties, and you get, you know, these types of situations where, you know, Gary Johnson, commits, you know, just a, you know, kind of a, kind of a weird gaffe. And
well, you know, I have to be fair about that, though. I do want to say something. I don't mean to interrupt you, but I do want to say something about that. He did, as far as I'm concerned, he did explain away his gaffe in a way that I understand. When somebody said Aleppo,
he was honest about it.
He's like, you know what? I thought you were talking about an acronym. And, you know, if somebody threw that name out to me and I wasn't thinking in terms of Syria at the time of the interview, somebody just, you know, we're talking about whatever, we're talking about, you know, domestic tax policy, and then somebody says, well, what about Aleppo? What's Aleppo? You know, that would be my first reaction, too. I just want to be fair on that because, you know, when they just threw it out to him, there was no context. They just said Aleppo.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, well, what is it? You know, I think he's getting too much flack for it. Now, I don't like the guy, but nonetheless, I think that he explained it away to my satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's not. I don't know that it's going to hurt him. And the funny thing that I saw was immediately this tool from Vanity Fair. There's a bunch of bourgeois media out there that really just has this sort of voracious hate, this visceral hatred of third parties. And this particular Vanity Fair author, I don't even know their name. No one's going to remember their name in 20 years. And, you know, this person was like, look at what Gary Johnson did this morning. Boy, it's been a really bad week for third party candidates. And I saw that and I said, what do you mean? This is something Gary Johnson did. So I clicked it on, and, you know, the other horrible news for third party candidates is that there's an arrest warrant out for Jill Stein.
Yeah.
For
I think it's great news, actually.
For spray painting a bulldozer up at Standing Rock. That is not – hello, Vanity Fair author. That is not a liability. Doing that is not a liability in terms of consolidating the voters that are going to vote for the Green Party. And this is something Bill McKibben has said. Bill McKibben came out and said this either today or yesterday, I think yesterday, said Hillary Clinton needs to get her butt up there to North Dakota and speak up in favor of the Native American side of that dispute. She needs to do it.
You know, that's
it's a missed opportunity. I've been critical of Bill McKibben in the past because sometimes I have felt like he hasn't been as strong as he should be or as forceful a voice against climate change as he should be. I felt like he's been too buddy-buddy with the Obama administration, but he has started to move away from that in the last few years. And I think what he said in terms of where Clinton needs to be is spot on. I think this is a real blight. And, of course, you know, she gets a lot of oil money. And the Democratic Party gets a lot of money from oil companies, and so I think it's a big deal that only one presidential candidate out of the four, you know, that we talk about the most, only one candidate was up there. And yeah, of course, there's an arrest warrant out there. Jill was arrested 4 years ago when she ran for trying to break in to the debates when she was excluded from the debate.
Oh yeah,
getting arrested is something that. That progressive candidates, the candidates representing progressive causes do. That's not a loss for third parties. There is no one. I guarantee you that no one is sitting on the fence on this going, should I vote for this Green Party candidate? Oh, she got arrested for protesting? Oh, I guess I'm not. I can't vote for her. She violated the law. There's no one who would be otherwise predisposed to vote for a Green Party candidate that would not vote for a Green Party candidate because they got arrested while protesting.
And that's interesting because at best they can get her for trespass to chattels because it was the front blade. She spray painted the front blade of a bulldozer, which is designed to scrape up against things. So it wouldn't be permanent anyway. So you can't call it conversion. She didn't damage the vehicle. All she did was spray paint it, which is something that was going to be scraped off anyway in the natural order of business. But I think that from the standpoint of – and you make the perfect point that, you know, a progressive, if you are a true progressive, you're not really a true progressive unless you've been arrested.
Or at least have stood up for those who do, you know.
Yeah.
It's the old which side are you on, you know, question. And so speaking of that, you know, in the same CNN politics article from last October talks about the 1920 campaign.
Matt, I just want to. You're kind of breaking up. Do you think? I know you're on your cell phone. Could you kind of maybe see if you could find a better spot? Maybe step outside or something if the weather is okay where you're at.
Sure. How does this sound?
That sounds a lot better.
Okay, great. So in 1920, Eugene Debs ran for president. It was the fifth time he had run for president. This was Warren G. Harding won that race, defeating Democrat James Cox. But what got interesting was that Debs ran his campaign from prison.
I remember that.
He had given an anti-war speech in 1918 in Canton, Ohio, in which he pilloried the ruling class who made the decisions to send the working class to war. And he uttered this phrase, which would become famous: "Yours is not to reason why, yours is but to do and die."
Yours is but to do and die.
And
yeah.
He was convicted under an espionage law, sentenced to 10 years in prison, and was later moved to the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary, from where he conducted his presidential campaign and secured how many votes? Anybody know? Anyone? Bueller?
A million? 2 million?
He received 900,000 votes.
Wow. Well, you know, I always thought that they arrested him because he had done some sort of thing through the post service, through the postal office, which was illegal. I didn't think they arrested him for any phrasing he said in a stump speech. I thought because that's First Amendment. How could they have done that with First Amendment? I mean, I always thought it was a postal thing. Mm-hmm. I was because he had said, you know, don't do the draft, or, you know, don't submit to the draft, and he sent letters to people through the post office. That was my misconception, but I always thought that's how they got him.
And many activists did get convicted for going through the post office, but there were, I'll just say this. So First Amendment jurisprudence in the 19-teens and 1920s was very inconsistent. You look at it now, you even see some of the justices, like Oliver Wendell Holmes, some of the things that they said about when the government can limit speech, is very, very different than what we would expect today. So it was not a complete departure from the jurisprudence of the time for Eugene Debs to find himself, with a 10-year prison sentence for speaking out against the war.
Well, you know, I've spoken with friends privately about this, but I think that. Now, what you're talking about is obviously quite different, but what we see right now with the Supreme – I didn't want to get off on the Supreme Court tonight, and I don't mind that we do, but I just wanted to point out that from my perspective, and I'm no legal scholar. I only have one year of law school under my belt, but from my perspective, I tend to think that this Supreme Court, at least when Scalia was alive, and I mean it still happens with four of them, but they look at who the parties are, and they look at who they want to win, and then they will twist themselves into legal pretzels to make sure that whichever side that they see that is before them they want to win, they will make it happen. I don't think at this point with this Supreme Court, especially with under the Roberts Court, I'm going to call it the Roberts Court, under the Roberts Court, that we don't have any semblance of independence. It all comes down to who is it that's before us? Which side do they want to win? I wouldn't be a bit surprised if we saw a case where Monsanto was on one side of a case this year and Monsanto was on another side of the case next year, exact same issues, and Monsanto wins both times. I would have no doubt that that would come out
sure.
if Scalia were still alive, because this Supreme Court looks at who the parties are. They decide who they want to win. Of course, it's always the party with the most money that is going to be the one that wins, and they will twist themselves into legal pretzels to make that happen. And so what they will do is they will do the same thing, and they would still do the same thing today. I have no doubt that even the progressives, or even the, if you want to call them, if you want to go so far as be generous and call them liberals on the Supreme Court today, would do the same thing to protect the two-party system. That if there were a legitimate threat, I mean a real threat from third parties, because they got enough support or what have you, grassroots or what have you, to where they were starting to win seats in the House and the Senate, that this mm-hmm. Supreme Court would find reasons to start restricting anything but the two-party system. We really have
well, we know the parties would do that. We know the parties
well,
would
yeah.
do that because they've done
but
it
the Supreme
in individual
Court
states.
They've, absolutely.
They have, you know, they've fought tooth and nail to keep other parties off the ballot. And so, you know, and I do have to say that, you know, Bernie Sanders last week on Meet the Press said something very cool. He said, you know, even though he thinks that people should vote for Hillary Clinton, you know, as the lesser of two evils, you know, he also said that he thought that the threshold for getting additional parties into the debates should be lower. And as you know, on this podcast, I have said in the past that I think that if there's a mathematical possibility that a candidate is on enough state ballots to win the Electoral College, if it's mathematically possible, that should qualify them for the debates. And so,
absolutely, I agree.
So I'm a big fan of that. Along those lines, Jill Stein, the Greens, just got on the ballot here in Wyoming. That's the first time that they've ever done that, and it is makes, I believe, 45 states that the Greens are on. A couple more that they're, I think, three more that they're waiting for results on, and I think two that they didn't make it. And of course, the Libertarians are on the ballot in all 50 states.
Yeah, and, you know, last I heard, and I might have read this a few days ago, I don't exactly remember, I thought it was 42 states that the Greens were on, Jill Stein was on in 42, but that would mathematically, I mean, unless the state she's not on the ballot in is like California, New York, and Texas, that would give her enough to be able to qualify for the debates under that theory.
It's 45 now.
Okay.
It is. Yeah, it's 45 states now, and I think that there is the possibility that the Greens will get on two or three more before all is said and done.
You know, before I forget, I wanted to, when you were mentioning that Jill Stein had got arrested at that protest in the Dakotas, I forget it was North or South Dakota. You know, why can't we just have one
North
Dakota?
Yeah, and the warrant is out. She was long gone before. By the time the warrant was out.
But you know, the people who protest, the people, not the people who are protesting. I think they're on the right on this. But the people who are saying that they shouldn't be protesting, that you know that the private security guards who unleashed the dogs on the protesters were right. You know, those kind of things. I saw a visual meme today about it, and it was very interesting, and it was very poignant. I think it made the exact point. If you would not allow an oil pipeline to pass through an American military veteran cemetery, if you would not allow us to go through a national cemetery, some VA cemetery, if you would not allow a oil pipeline to go through that, why should you want to see an oil pipeline go through the sacred lands of the tribes? And if you can't answer that,
I couldn't agree more.
If your answer is, well, I wouldn't want a pipeline to go through to go over these graves, well, you know what? Then you have just agreed with those tribes, because their position isn't against oil per se, although that's a big, that could be a big part of their argument anyway, but that's not their position. Their position is you are taking our land. Yeah, I mean, this is land that was guaranteed to them by treaty centuries ago. When we finally said, hey, let's make peace with the tribes, we made a treaty with these sovereign nations, and they are sovereign nations. Just be a banker and try to lend them money. You'll see, they
yeah,
are
exactly.
sovereign nations.
With 30 seconds left,
yep.
I reiterate that that Hillary Clinton, if she really wants to, you know, prove her credentials with her constituency, should get up there and should say something about it. We just have a few seconds left. We'll be back next week, obviously. We will not be around the following week. But thanks again, Gary, for a wonderful 30 minutes.
Thank you, Matt. I want to thank our audience for listening. We're coming up to the last few seconds. I want to play the music as an outro on the podcast part of it. Please join us next week, and I will see you next week, Matt. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
All right. Good night, everybody.